Reverend Harry Bridge.
And I am Dr. Scott Mitchell, and this is the Dharma Realm Podcast.
And we are coming to you from the Kodo of the Jodo Shinshu Center in Berkeley, California. This is the Dharma Realm Podcast for April 17th, 2008, and this is part two of our discussion of American Buddhism. Now, one of the things that I am interested in the context of this issue of American Buddhism is, well, you can think about it, I guess, in two kind of ways. How do I become a Buddhist? And that's something that a couple of people have asked me as a minister, mm-hmm. is how do I become a Buddhist? And I think to look at that question, you kind of have to ask, well, yeah, what is a Buddhist?
Or who is a Buddhist?
Or who is a Buddhist, right? What qualifies you as a Buddhist? How do you get there? What do you do? And one of the things, I think, is that you just have an interest in Buddhism.
Right.
Right? And I think the way a lot of us do that is by reading.
Uh-huh.
And that there's a lot of information out there in books that helps us as kind of, not necessarily intellectual, but kind of stimulates that intellectual curiosity about what is Buddhism, right? And you can begin reading and finding books that look at that question and teach you about Buddhism. And so maybe you, and then kind of speaking from my own experience too, where I encountered Buddhism and was fascinated by it and then discovered books about Buddhism, mm-hmm. and that just set me running. And I started reading more and more and more, and I voraciously read as much as I possibly could. But then I think there comes a point then when you're kind of like, well, I'm reading about all this stuff, but am I really a Buddhist?
Right.
You know, or maybe I feel like I am a Buddhist, but does reading books make you a Buddhist? Is that, quote unquote, enough? Is it sufficient to become a Buddhist? And so there's this one category of, I guess, either bookstore Buddhists or bedstand Buddhists or nightstand Buddhists.
Right. Huh. That Thomas Tweed came up with several years ago. And what he was talking about was this category of people who read a bunch of books about Buddhism, and maybe they even do some Buddhist meditation practices or other kinds of Buddhist practices, but they don't necessarily belong to a community.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they go to a local, you know, meditation center once in a while. Maybe they don't. And he also noticed there are people out there who call themselves Buddhists and read lots of Buddhist books, but actually belong to a Christian church, for example, because maybe their spouse or somebody in their family is of that religion. And so they from the outside sort of look like a Christian or a Jew or whatever, but they consider themselves Buddhists. And I think it's interesting that they would, I think it's an interesting phenomenon. and I think that, you know, that if somebody calls themselves a Buddhist, then from an academic point of view, we should take that seriously and say, okay, there are people who call themselves Buddhists, but they don't belong to a Buddhist community, which is how we have traditionally defined sort of group membership, I guess you could say. But I think it's, you know, your experience is actually very similar to my experience of first coming across Buddhism in this intellectual way. And I was actually very resistant to joining for a very long time. So how do you become a Buddhist, I guess, is a question.
Well, I was resistant too, where I was really into it. And I was resistant in a way, though, I think, where I felt like I wasn't ready to commit.
Mm-hmm.
And that if I committed to this, then I'd have to really take it seriously. And I knew that I kind of wasn't up until that point. And I was trying to, quote unquote, practice Buddhism, even though I didn't really know what that meant, working at Starbucks and serving coffee and dealing with frustrated people and all that kind of thing. And I was trying to do it, but I also knew that I was not doing it very well and getting angry at people or whatever, you know, or in my mind, not doing it well. And so the kind of pivotal experience for me was going to New York City, and there's a BCA temple there in New York, and going to a service and sitting down, and we must have chanted a sutra, and maybe we sang a song, and then we chanted Buddham Saranam Gacchami, Dhammam Saranam Gacchami, Sangham Saranam Gacchami, and we finished, and I realized, oh, oops. Like, I knew enough to realize that I just chanted the Triple Refuge,
mm-hmm.
and that meant something.
Uh-oh.
To me anyway. Because traditionally, I think the way to, quote-unquote, become a Buddhist, mm-hmm. is to take refuge in the Triple Gem with a community. It doesn't mean to just say it on your own, right? Although I would think you could. But I think traditionally it meant in the presence of monks and a community to recite the Triple Refuge, to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And I did it. And I did it by accident. Yeah, unintentionally. I did it by accident. And so, again, you know, this gets into the whole issue of intention. Does just reciting it, is that enough? Do I need to mean what I say?
Right.
If I don't recite it, but I mean it anyway, is that good enough? You know, and, you know, we don't need to get so much into that now. But to me, I didn't mean it in a way. When I read it, I recited it mindlessly. And yet, I remember feeling like, oh man, I became Buddhist. Like, to me, it was like a real turning point. Like, I felt like, oops, I just recited it. Now I've made a commitment.
Almost like a disappointment.
Well, no, it was a little, no, I think it was more apprehension, but also happiness. Because I think I knew that's what I wanted to do,
right.
But I wasn't ready to make that step. And the step was almost made for me in a way, right? But having come from that bookstore Buddhist point of view too, I have sympathy for that.
Right.
Experience too, because it's not easy to get into a community. It's not easy to join a community and to find a community even, and to find one that suits you.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I was actually having an email exchange with somebody recently about this exact issue, and I realized in that exchange, because he lives someplace where there's not a lot of Shin communities, but you know, here in the Bay Area, they're everywhere. It's really easy to find different Buddhist communities, but regardless of that, I also had a very hard time finding a community. When I was looking for, when I was first starting out and first interested in Buddhism, part of my, you know, hesitancy to call myself a Buddhist was because I didn't belong to a community, and I felt like that was sort of the last step, right? Like, I could do all these sort of Buddhist things, I could live a Buddhist lifestyle, whatever that means, I could do all this other stuff, I could read, I could, you know, whatever. But if I didn't belong to a community, then I wasn't really a Buddhist, was my feeling at the time. And so I went around for a long time looking for different communities, and it was really hard to find one that made sense to me. There was always something sort of didn't quite fit, whether it was, you know, that community wasn't as welcoming, or, you know, this other community had certain ideas about Buddhism I disagreed with, or, you know, the practice didn't quite feel right. I was lousy at meditation, all of those different things. So it's interesting that it was like I was surrounded by Buddhism, but couldn't commit.
Oh, wow.
Or couldn't find the right place. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I was on the East Coast, and looking back, there actually were Buddhist communities around, but you can even have communities, like you're just saying, you can have communities around, but it's not the right time,
right.
Or it's not the right group of people, or whatever. It's not the easiest thing to get into, huh? There's also the issue, though, that books are an important way in, and I think it's a way in for many people, but there are also people that don't want to read.
Mm.
You know, and so that's been kind of interesting too, where I realized that a lot of times you feel like, you know, someone says, oh, I'm interested in Buddhism, and you say, well, here, read this book, which kind of implies I don't have time to explain it to you all, which isn't what I mean. And you don't have time to explain it all, for one thing.
Right.
You know, it's just, that's impossible.
Yeah.
I think a person, if they really want to get interested, and they're coming kind of from the outside, they do need to educate themselves to a certain extent. But I also am realizing that there have to be other, and you know, maybe this podcast is one way, giving lectures at my own church or study classes is another way, having people come to church, you know, that's kind of education too, I think, because, you know, my Dharma talk, I try to gear it so that people will hear something maybe just from everyday life, so they don't feel like it's something far away and dry and academic, but I also try to give them some hardcore Dharma too, so that it's not just empty, just kind of joking around for 45 minutes or half hour or whatever.
Hardcore Dharma, I like that.
Yeah, you know, hit them hard sometimes.
Well, yeah, that makes me think that's true, that books can really only go so far anyway, even if somebody doesn't want to read a book, or if somebody does want to read a book, you know, books are written with a particular perspective, right? And can't answer all of your questions. That, you know, you can read the best book ever about Buddhism and still be like, well, what does this mean?
Right.
Or, you know, I've learned all this stuff about Buddhism from this book, and then something happens in my life. How do I deal with it? What do I, you know, what's the response? What, you know, how should I feel, or whatever. And these are questions that, you know, books can't always answer. So I think that you need to read a book in conversation with somebody else, right? That at some point you take these ideas from a book and say, oh, this was a really good book. What do you think about it? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and your role as a minister might be to clarify or to be like, I don't know.
Right.
Well, I don't know what to make of this.
What book are you talking about again?
Which is part
of...
I don't know. Read this other one instead. But that's part of the whole process, right? Is like figuring out not just what one book says or even 50 books say, but also figuring out what they don't say or mm-hmm, how they apply to different situations or don't apply or whatever. I mean, like you said, it's impossible to tell somebody everything because there's just too much stuff.
Yeah. And the other thing with books too is that I'm realizing is the kind of books that I like tend to be more, I think, academic, whether it's philosophical or historical
right.
or whatever. And those aren't good books to recommend to people because they're too hard.
That's true.
You know? And so I don't tend to read the books that are kind of more on the practitioner side.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Thich Nhat Hanh's books or, you know, or even like The Art of Happiness.
Right.
I don't know if I could get through that just because it's not really what I want to read. It's not what I'm interested in to hear that kind of almost secularized Buddhism, it seems like.
Yeah.
Not secularized, but like really taking away any ethnic and any institutional kind of trappings. And like,
right.
You know, it's cool in a way. You know, it's like...
It's like Buddhism light.
Well, but it's distilling it to a very potent point, I think.
Right.
But then the critical side is always coming in and being like, yeah, but the Dalai Lama's got a lot of other books that are really hard. And I like those better, personally. His introduction to the Tibetan Book of the Dead is amazing.
Oh, really?
It's hardcore Buddhist philosophy. Yeah, it's like it's Abhidharma kind of stuff, and it's great.
That's, cool.
It's not for the same audience that the Art of Happiness is.
Yeah. There was this thing going around online 6 or 8 months ago of Buddhist bloggers listing their 5 favorite Buddhist books, and somebody tagged me to list mine, and so I sort of hunted around and looked at other lists, and the lists were, you know, maybe a dozen or two books altogether. You know, they're all kind of the same thing, and they were a lot of those kinds of books, right? The kind of books you can find at any bookstore. And I was like thinking about my books and being like, huh, wow. I have these like really weird postmodern hypercritical academic things that I think are really cool. Huh.
Yeah.
I'm a dork.
So I did have a person come into me and ask me, how do I become a Buddhist? And it's interesting because I haven't actually met this person. I haven't been able to talk to him. We've emailed a few times and just haven't had the chance for the conversation to even begin. But it got me thinking about this, about how do I become a Buddhist? You know, and I think that idea of taking the 3 refuges is important. But it's maybe, well, you know, you can do it at the beginning, I think, if you know that's what you want to do. But I think you got to look into it, too. I mean, it's
really like that shouldn't be the first thing you do.
Well, I think for traditionally it would be.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that would just be kind of assumed.
Right.
Do that, you know. But I think in America we're so cynical and we don't trust, quote-unquote, religion. And, you know, we don't want to get the wool pulled over our eyes, right? We don't want to be had, right? So you want to look into it first, right? And do some research or whatever and make sure that these people aren't going to scam you
kind of thing.
Yeah. And then you can take refuge. I think that's kind of where I'm coming from because I'm so used to people being so pessimistic about religion. And I'm so used to people just not trusting religion at all.
I don't think that's... I think there's something to be said for that model of conversion within Buddhism too, right? Like in the old stories, in all the sutras and whatnot, there's these stories of people coming to the Buddha and talking to him and then converting, right? Like the Buddha will say something, you know, Buddha said blah, 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 and then so-and-so realized the truth of what the Buddha was saying and then took refuge.
So I think that
there is something to be said for that, that there's, you know, it isn't this thing you sort of walk blindly into and like, oh, these people look happy. I'll become a Buddhist.
Right.
You know something going in.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
No. I think that's a good point. And, you know, that story of the Buddha saying, don't believe this because I told you, because it was me that said it. Look at it for yourself and investigate it. And if it seems like it works, then yeah, go for it, kind of thing. I think that may that be, we can probably find many examples in the Buddhist tradition where that wasn't necessarily how it was done.
Right.
But there is that original story. I think it's the Nibbana Sutta,
uh-huh.
right? That's the time of when the Buddha actually passed away. And so it, that model, I mean, that's where I think the Europeans, you know, when they first discovered Buddhism and they started looking into this stuff,
yeah.
not when they
yeah.
first discovered, but when they started actually finding texts
yeah.
and they discovered that attitude, they were like, uh-huh, right? This really appeals to us because we've been force-fed the church
religion.
And religion here in Europe for so long, and now we're trying to break free of it. And now we find this religion that's saying, you know, don't believe it because it's dogma. Don't believe it because you're supposed to believe it. Believe it because it works, because you tried it and you
right.
found that it's true. Yeah, so that's definitely in there. That's not how it always works, but I keep flipping back and forth. I think I'm too much of a Libra. I keep, you
that's
know,
not very Buddhist, Eric.
I know. Well, I don't know. No, balance. I think it is. Trying to find the balance between the extremes of right.
right.
Sometimes
right.
I think we cling too much to statements about or ideas that Buddhism is totally rational. It's totally right. There's no ritual at all or whatever. It's
right.
obviously not true. We could maybe say, no, Buddhism is basically ritual.
Yeah,
and
all
people
Buddhism
don't have
really
to
is.
Really believe or yeah. think anything. They can just do this stuff,
right.
which is true to a certain extent. But I think that's also an extreme. And so I, you know, I think ideally there's kind of a middle path where we do have these beliefs and believe in certain things, and there's also things that we do, but we don't. Neither one of those is like absolutely required.
Right, and yeah. and neither one of those will get you all the way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you look at the, you know, the Eightfold Path, right, there's, sure, there's right meditation and right practice, but there's also right belief.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's right thought. Mm-hmm. Right, you have to know certain things about the way that the world works and, you know, on a cosmological or whatever kind of level that you need to think about this stuff too, right? So I think that it's true that you do have to have both. You have to mm-hmm. do, the Buddhism is a lot of practice. It's a lot of ritual, but there's also certain beliefs about the world
mm-hmm.
that balance it out. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, sometimes it's said, in Buddhism, we don't believe anything. Have you ever heard anyone say that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh. Of course. Then what about impermanence?
Right, yeah.
I mean, and it's not that we have
or
to believe.
Or interconnection, or
yeah.
compassion, or.
Or suffering,
yeah.
or, yeah. There are doctrines and, like, things that the Buddha taught about reality, and to not see things in that way is wrong view
yeah.
if you cling to the other one.
Right.
And so I think the point is that you don't believe it because someone told you to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the point. But there is still, I think, a belief after having examined it for yourself
right.
and found it to be, to have some truth.
And it's that metaphor of the raft, right? Of crossing the river and getting to the other shore. You use the raft, and in the metaphor, the raft is the doctrine of the practice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then when you get to the far shore, you let go of it. You don't carry the raft around with you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, while you're on the river, which I think most of us are,
mm-hmm.
you still need to use something.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
can't get rid of the raft in the middle of the river.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah, whenever I hear somebody say, oh, Buddhism doesn't have beliefs, it's like, well, maybe you don't have beliefs when you've reached the far shore, but I'm not there yet.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I don't trust that you are either.
uh-huh.
Maybe you are. Yeah, and I think, you know, in this conversation of how do you become a Buddhist, one of the things that often frustrates me about non-Buddhists or even, you know, quasi-Buddhists' preconceptions about Buddhism is this equation I see them making where they equate being a Buddhist and being enlightened.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
You know, where they'll say, you know, this happens to me quite frequently because mm-hmm. people will, you know, I don't practice. You know, I don't meditate. I practice, but I don't, you know, do meditation or,
mm-hmm.
you know, I drink alcohol occasionally, you know, sometimes I swear, you know, I do these things that are like un-Buddhist and people look at me like I'm crazy. And I just look at them like, you know, I'm not enlightened.
Yeah. That's so weird, huh?
I'm still on the path. I'm still working to get somewhere. And
mm-hmm.
that's a huge difference. You know, there's a huge difference between being a Buddhist and being a Buddha.
Yeah. Well, that also, I think, gets back to this idea of people's perception of what Buddhism is.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about, you know, people's perception of what American Buddhism is, but there are people that maybe who aren't Buddhist, right? But they perceive Buddhism being this certain way, and then they can't, I don't know.
Right.
they just don't want to bother looking into what the reality of it is, maybe, or
yeah. Or equating it with other things they know, right? Sort of quasi New Age ideas about, you know, whatever. He said disdainfully.
Yeah, I mean, it's asking people, a lot of people, huh, to actually stop and think about something,
right,
and to maybe question your own thoughts or beliefs. Most people probably just don't care,
yeah,
I think, right? But then if someone's engaged you at that point, you would hope that they'd be willing to put a little bit of effort in, maybe, right? And
open up to some other possibilities.
Yeah, yeah.
Other ways of thinking about things.
Yeah,
yeah. So I don't think you really answered the question of how you become a Buddhist.
Oh, I didn't? join my church and pay the dues. Then you're in. You get a newsletter, too.
That's not how I became a Buddhist.
Well, they'll be collecting your back dues any day now. No, to me, taking the triple refuge, personally, is an important, very important part of it. Now, I have a lot of members of my church that we recited every Sunday, you know, but I think for some of them, they may feel that they're Buddhist because they are a member of the church.
Right, right.
And because their parents were Buddhists and their grandparents. And, yeah, they're Buddhists too, even if they don't mean it when they recite the Triple Refuge and don't particularly care or whatever. You know, and I don't know. For all of them, most of the time I don't know, especially the kids.
Yeah,
I have no idea how they're taking what I'm saying, or how they feel when they, you know, recite this or whatever.
Right. Of course. I mean, that's the other side of it, is that you don't know what's going on in somebody else's head or their heart. Right. That's the other side of this. I think some people get upset when there are people who don't behave like Buddhists. You know, but who are we to say that they're, you know, like from the outside, you can look at somebody and say, oh, this person is not behaving like a Buddhist because they're not doing something I think that they should be doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you don't know what's going on inside their head, which is important, right? Like your whole congregation might from the outside look like they don't care, but, you know, in their hearts, they might.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah, no idea.
You're not a Buddha.
Yeah. That's true.
You're a hell of an enlightened guy, but.
No. No, I was saying the other day, I was looking at this text about the preliminaries to the path or something, the Tibetan kind of idea of that there are things that you need. Actually, why didn't I think of this? There's this idea of the ordinary and the extraordinary or extraordinary preliminaries. And the ordinary ones are that you, recognize that you have this precious human rebirth. This perfect human rebirth. You contemplate death and the idea that you could die at any time, and it could happen any time or place, and that you will die. The third one is contemplating the law of cause and effect, the law of karma. And the fourth one is contemplating the misery of samsara. And so that someone who wants to become Buddhist should do these things.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I love reading this stuff.
What an uplifting list.
Yeah. It's really kind of crazy. So that needs to be tempered too. And, you know, I wouldn't preach this to my congregation, but I did bring it up at my study class.
Uh-huh.
And then the extraordinary ones are taking refuge, awakening bodhicitta, awakening the mind aspiring for enlightenment. And then it goes into prostrations, bowing to a Buddha image, and then it goes into the more tantric kind of things because it is Tibetan and it is a specific sect of Tibetan Buddhism. But there you go. That's one take on how do I become a Buddhist.
Learn something first, then do the...
Yeah, and learn something very difficult to learn, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Recognize how important the fact that how lucky you are to have achieved human birth.
Huh.
Right? Look at... the fact that you will die, right? Which a lot of people may not want to do, right? So this has to be, I think, in a kind of guided context.
Yeah.
And then learning about karma and learning about samsara. So this is also very much the traditional, literal understanding of the six realms, too, and of reincarnation. So there's another kind of way in, And it does imply study, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then taking refuge is the first step of the extraordinary one. So when you actually, you go, okay, I've realized, you know, I'm lucky to have been born a human, and that I'm going to die someday. I don't have a minute to lose. Actually, the triple refuge that BCA uses, difficult is it to be born into human life, now I'm living it, implies that too.
Right, right.
This text that I was reading, though, goes into way much more detail than we ever go into in a sermon or at church, I think, so in the BCA anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's cool, though.
Yeah. Oh, I love those Tibetan. They're like the Tibetan Text Translation Society or something.
Okay.
From the 70s. When they started translating texts. And so when they're from India, right? They're like Indian publications.
Uh-huh.
So they're hard to find now. Hmm. Shambhala had them all the time, Shambhala books. But now that's gone, it's really hard to find these Indian publications.
Hmm.
Now, one of the things that is kind of interesting to me is that, you know, I lived in Japan and studied Buddhism in Japan for about 3 years, starting in around 2002, and so I've had some exposure to Japanese Buddhism as well, and Jodo Shinshu in Japan, and Buddhism in Japan, and, you know, what we've been talking about reading books, and for some reason getting interested in Buddhism, and then reading about it, and wanting to learn more, and, you know, I can't speak for all Japanese people, but unfortunately, I think that is not happening in Japan nearly to the extent that it is happening here in the United States, and it's kind of sad. Because, you know, Buddhism has flourished in Japan for centuries, and there are still beautiful temples there. And I think probably all Japanese people, maybe not all, but many, many, a huge percentage of the population of Japan go to Japanese temples or Buddhist temples in Japan when they're in junior high school or high school on what's called Shugaku Ryoko, which is basically a field trip. And so if you ever go to Japan and you see a big, huge wave of like an ocean of kids in their, young Japanese kids in their school uniforms, they're probably on this field trip thing. And if you're in Kyoto, very likely they're going to go to the big, yeah, the big temples there. And they're going as tourists.
Right.
So they encounter Buddhism, but my impression is that they're not really encountering the teachings. They're just seeing these kind of like physical manifestations of it.
Yeah.
And they never get excited about it. And it's just kind of turned into this kind of tourist Buddhism, which is a class of Buddhism in Japan, I guess. That's kind of a category that Japanese scholars have, is tourist Buddhism. And that was actually my experience, was that I went on a study trip in about 98 and then stayed on for the summer. And my whole thing was like, wow, I'm here in Kyoto for the summer. I'm going to go to temples. So I started going to temples, and I went to Ryoanji and all over the place. And finally, it just kind of got boring. And it was too hot was another thing. But I stopped going. And thinking later, I realized it was because every morning I was going to Nishihonganji at 6 a.m. Uh-huh. for morning service. And I was going together with all these other followers. And together we were chanting Shoshinge. And so we were practicing together. I was having like
a
religious experience yeah, going to Honganji. So later on in the day when I'd go to some temple with these beautiful works of art, it was like going to a museum.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you couldn't encounter that Buddhism there. It was kind of held off behind a fence or something, you know, yeah. that said, do not enter. You could look, but there was no way to engage with it. And I think that's what the Buddhist experience of most Japanese people.
Yeah, that's the exact experience I had when I was in Tokyo a couple years ago, and I went down to Kamakura,
mm-hmm.
and I went to all these little Zen temples and whatnot. It was that experience of one temple after another when it was really hot.
Uh-huh. The heat always has to be in there, right? Uh-huh.
And, you know, but there was a lot of tourist sort of activity and gift shops, you know, set mm-hmm. up inside the temples and whatnot. But, yeah, you couldn't go very close to there was a distance between you and the religious aspect of it, I guess you could say.
Yeah, yeah.
But even still, I also saw a lot of people, even at the Daibutsu, you know, the really big Buddha, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, the really big Buddha is really funny because it's this gigantic Buddha and it's very touristy. It's very, uh-huh. very touristy. But even there, I saw people, you know, offering incense and doing prostrations and doing, you know, religious things.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. You see it sometimes.
Yeah.
And I would see it too sometimes. And but I think
it's not the norm.
Yeah, and so I want to be careful not to characterize all Japanese people as, you know, being not Buddhist somehow. Right. Or, you know, but I think you're right. There are people that, you know, they went to Kamakura and they recognize, wow, this is really important and, you know, maybe spiritually powerful for them.
Right.
But I think a lot of people, it's another spot on the stop on the tourist.
Which is, and the reason we bring this up is because it's an interesting way to get interested in Buddhism on that process of eventually converting, if you will, or taking refuge, right?
Mm-hmm.
That how do you become interested in Buddhism? And I feel like in America, we're at this weird stage right now where Buddhism has really permeated popular culture, right?
Uh-huh.
If you look at popular culture, there's lots of references to Buddhism and other Asian religions, and, you know, it's sort of just sort of kind of out there, and it's not always an accurate representation. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less, but, you know, you can definitely buy lots of stuff with mm-hmm. Buddhas on it, or little Buddha statues,
yeah.
Or, you know, you can... There's a product called the Zen clock, for example, that, you know, instead of a horrible alarm clock, it's like a chime that rings slowly, right, like a little bell.
Is that the one with the circle that goes around? Like,
yeah,
I kind of want one of those.
So do I. But it's totally interesting to me that there's all these little products, and I've known a lot of people who've been really put off by what they see as like Buddhism and consumerism. And
there's like a catalog too, Dharma something or other, that has all these statues.
Yeah, tons of catalogs.
Yeah.
And some of them are more, I guess you could say, spiritual or religious. Like I've seen some catalogs that have, you know, zafus and actual, you know, like
they're
Buddha
for
statues
Buddhists in a way. They're trying to meet a need of people.
Ritual objects and mm-hmm. things for your altar, which is great. But then it has mixed in there this weird, you know, other mm-hmm. stuff that nobody really needs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, I don't know. I think that it's you can sort of be dismissive of it and be like, oh, it's just, you know, capitalism and consumerism and they've commodified Buddhism and it's not serious and it's not really Buddhism. But for some people, I think it works as their way in,
mm-hmm,
right? It's
mm-hmm.
their way to become interested. Even if at first they're like, oh, it's a Buddha, I'll put that next to my dream catcher or, you know, or whatever. You know, eventually maybe they'll learn more about Buddhism in a more sincere kind of way. I don't want to say serious or
mm-hmm,
or authentic, but, you know, in a more sincere kind of way of like, oh, I want to learn more about this. And then that begins their sort of opens them up to the possibility of taking it more seriously. I don't like using that phrase.
I think we know what you're saying. Well, actually, for me, you know, I had gotten interested in Buddhism. And when I went to Japan to study abroad there in 1990, I took a class, Introduction to Buddhism. And so it was good for me because I think I have the intellectual kind of bent. I like to think about things and read about things. So I learned a lot in that way, but there was almost nothing spiritual about it.
Right.
It was all intellectual. And I remember near the end of my trip, I went to Shimokitazawa in Tokyo, which is this kind of hip little area, and there's like art galleries and stuff. And I went into this one store and found these amazing postcards. And they were by a Japanese person, but they were Tibetan style. They were like pictures of Tibetan tankas. And they were just incredible. They're so I have them still. They were so beautiful and intricate. Even though they were just these little postcards, and I got like Avalokiteshvara and Amitayus and Shakyamuni and like eight disciples and Yamantaka and like these incredible tankas.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of spoiled me because it's such a high level of painting that ever since then I'm very critical about, you know, there are a lot of tankas that I see that I don't really like, you know, I'm like, you know, because that became my standard.
Right.
I was spoiled at the beginning. But those were really important to me too, because I was interested in Buddhism and I felt like I wanted to be a Buddhist, but I didn't know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know any communities around me. And so I had these postcards and I remember putting one up on my door to my room. And so I had these and they were, I don't know, they kept me going in a way.
Yeah.
They gave me a focus for my, you know, my Buddhist interest. And only recently I finally went online to try and find it. And I found, I think his name is Kenji Babasaki is the artist, and he's Japanese, and he went to Nepal in the 70s or something and saw these paintings, and he became a disciple to a professional painter.
Mm-hmm.
And so became this just amazing painter of these tankas.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh.
And it's also interesting because those, you know, tankas are, you know, they're, these beautiful paintings, but they're also ritual objects.
That
they use them in these hardcore visualization meditative practices.
It's not just a painting that, like Andy Warhol poster to slap up on your wall or something, right?
It's interesting that that's part of your in, right? Is that you chose something that you thought was aesthetically beautiful, but it also has this pretty important ritual component to it that maybe you didn't use in that way, but it's also, I don't know, tankas and mandalas and those sorts of that genre of art, I guess you could say, is very fascinating to me because it's not this totally separate kind of static art that we think of in the West, right? In the West, art is this thing that that's separate from you. You look at a painting or you look at a photograph or go to the museum to look at these things. But in the Buddhist context, these things are ritual objects that you use in your practice. And they have a sort of life of their own. And there's all kinds of stories of people actually making offerings to paintings, making offerings to statues. And, you know, there's this thing you can do as a scholar and say, oh, well, that's just the symbolic representation of the other thing. And it's not, you know, the statue isn't really alive and, you know, But I mean, for a lot of people, both, you know, 1,000 years ago and today, there's a lot of important meaning personally to doing these, offertory activities, right, to inanimate objects, you know, that has a certain power and interest.
Absolutely. You know, I used to love going to museums and, you know, getting interested in Buddhism and living in Boston. And I discovered the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston has an amazing East Asian art collection. And I forget the guy's name, but you can look it up on the internet. He, you know, in the early 20th century or whatever, went to Japan and got a lot of Buddhist art. And I used to love going there. And looking at the statues and then going to San Francisco, the Asian Art Museum, and seeing pictures of art objects that I had seen in books.
Right.
You know, because I love Buddhist art, and I would buy, you know, Japanese art or whatever. If you find a book on Japanese art, it will have Buddhist stuff in there because that's a huge part of Japanese art. And then I'd see the actual thing from Central Asia. It's like sitting right in front of me in this, you know, case. But one of the things I realized is that it's kind of weird. Because 99% of the people that used this object or, you know, had it as a ritual object never looked at it in the way that we do and would never dream of treating it as an object in that sense, something to be studied and something to be looked at and, you know, looked at minutely and from all angles. Yeah. And for one thing, it's usually below you.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
If you go to a museum, these Buddhist images are below you to a certain extent. They may be up at eye level. That would never have been treated that way. It would have been above you, and you would not be able to walk around it and look at it and look at the top and everything. And actually, there are stories that how the top of the Buddha's head is not supposed to be visible. Obviously, in an object, you can look at it, but there's this idea of the Buddha that the top of the Buddha's head can't be seen. And Honen tells this story in the Saiho Shinansho about, he's talking, quoting from a sutra, and I've never found the original, but that this bodhisattva wanted to see the top of the Buddha's head, and so he'd wanted to measure the height of the Buddha, and he'd get all these sticks together and try to measure, and he could never do it. It was like impossible. Kind of like, I don't know, like the TARDIS or something, right? It looks small from the outside, but you go inside and it's huge, right? Yeah. And so the same with the Buddha. He seems to have a measured fixed height, but you can't get from above and look down. And Buddhist art, Buddhist images in museums kind of don't get it.
Yeah.
They're missing a fundamental part of looking at Buddhist art, I think, and how images would traditionally have been treated.
Right.
And I've taken pictures of the Buddha image at my church recently, and I kind of realized, and I wrote there that, you know, this is a close-up of the image, but most people would never see it from here. Only the minister really gets to see it from up there because it's in the Nijin.
Right.
It's in the back of the Nijin. So normally the closest you get is when you're doing Oshoko, when you're standing in front and bowing to the image, which is how usually the relationship you have as a Buddhist to an image. It's not something to be objectified and studied.
It's a reverential. Right?
It's something to be worshipped
and
treated with respect. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, this is, 15, 20 years of of Buddhist experience. And a lot of this stuff is just coming, I'm realizing, you know, like in the past 5 years or so, about looking at Buddha. I still love Buddhist art, and I'll still go to museums and that right. kind of thing. But
yeah, it's I have the same experience going to the SF Asian Art Museum, and mm-hmm. it's huge, especially mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in the new building.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just goes on forever, but it's always interesting to go and look at the Buddhist art and read the little signs and you know, now that I have this sort of background of academic study, it's like they got it right.
Right. I mean, I appreciate it because there's some times when there's something I want to teach in a class or whatever, and I can go to these catalogs. Yeah, I love buying catalogs of Buddhist art exhibits, and you know, because you can use that stuff too.
Yeah,
to illustrate a point.
Oh, sure.
Right, and to have
sure.
a picture of that really helps too, I think, for people.
And it's also, I mean, you know, not to disparage museums too much, a lot of this stuff wouldn't exist in its native country now anyway.
That's true. That's true. It would have been destroyed and it wasn't
Central
valued
Asia
at the time.
Or South Asia, yeah.
Or Japan.
I mean, or Japan.
A lot of the Japanese stuff was being burned up or right. melted down.
Right.
Yeah, so that's what I think it was Asian Art Museum and Museum of Fine Arts were two of the ones. The two guys mm-hmm. went to Japan and they collected this stuff because
yeah.
the other people didn't care. They right. didn't value it.
Right. Yeah, especially bronze statues right before the war, mm-hmm, melting mm-hmm. it down for... That's a sad thought.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think that, you know, art and images and whatnot is definitely a powerful way to learn about Buddhism as sort of a first step, right? It's like you can see this image and, you know, particularly images of the six realms, you know, the sort of traditional image of the wheel and mm-hmm, the mm-hmm. weird demon guy who's hanging mm-hmm. over it. And
yeah.
Which is a sort of a scary image, but it tells a whole story and you can learn more about it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sort of ambivalent about, you know, tourist Buddhism or sort of commercial Buddhism. It's like, well, at least people are learning about it.
Yeah.
Which is not bad, but mm-hmm. there should be something more and leading somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
In my not so humble opinion.
Well, this has been the Dharma Realm podcast, and today our topic was Buddhism in America. No, it wasn't. It was American Buddhism.
And other things.
So thank you for joining us and listening, and we will be speaking about Buddhism again soon.